The Kosciusko had a personnel complement the size of a small city or large orbital station, and the officer list alone was as large as the crew of any normal ship. Esme knew that, in the intellectual sense, but when she saw the mass of ensigns jamming the lecture hall and crowding the passage outside, numbers became experience. Ensign Detton had offered to introduce her.
You're not all in the tactics discussion group, surely?
No, sir, but a lot of the others wanted to come. I'll have to shift some of them out because they're overloading the compartment.
Esme could see that. All the seats had been taken long ago. Ensigns were crowded knee to knee in front and were sitting squashed together in the aisles and in back. They were jamming the passage outside, too. She watched Detton trying to shoo them back out to no avail. She should, she realized, have told someone more senior about this. If she'd thought it would be more than a dozen or so ensigns, she would have. Detton wasn't getting anywhere, and it was her responsibility. She reached for the microphone.
Excuse me. How many of you are regular members of the tactics discussion group?
A few hands went up, about what she'd expected originally.
This meeting was scheduled for that group. We can't have a mob scene like this. It's not safe. Those of you who are not members of the discussion group will have to leave until we're sure we have seating for that group, and then we'll see how many others we can accommodate.
These were ensigns, and she was a full lieutenant now. Squirming awkwardly, those crammed into the aisles began to stand up. Those in front waited, perhaps hoping for a reprieve, but Esme gave them a stern look. Slowly, more awkwardly than necessary, they heaved themselves up and shuffled out. Some of those in seats were now standing. Some sat as if glued in place. She hoped those were all discussion group members.
Ensign Detton?
Detton looked mildly embarrassed.
Make sure all the discussion group members have seats. You know them all, don't you?
Yes, sir.
When they're seated, and if it's agreeable to the others, I don't mind having any spare seats filled, but that's all.
Sir, all here but two. They may be outside.
Go check on them, by name.
He made his way up the crowded aisle and called out into the passage. A knot of ensigns congealed in the opening, and finally two more elbowed their way in. That left seats for another two dozen, Esme figured. She wished she knew a fair way to allocate those seats, but it was too late for that. More quickly than they'd left, more ensigns came in until all seats were filled.
Well, I'm pleased to introduce Lieutenant Esme Suiza, who I'm sure really needs no introduction. She agreed to speak to us about the Xavier incident, which needs no introduction either. So, Lieutenant?
The lights dimmed, except where Esme stood. The eager young faces faded into a blur with highlights of eyes and teeth. She had not expected that, but after standing in the glare of flag officers' disapproval, she was not about to crumple in a merely visual spotlight. She had prepared a display cube with the same information given in court: the geometry of the Xavier system, the disposition of fleet vessels, available Xavierin and civilian vessels, the number and armament of the invaders. She had been over this so many times for her counsel and for Board of Inquiry and for the court-martial that she could have explained in her sleep just how outnumbered Serrano had been even before Hearn defected. Breathless silence while she spoke, reciting the familiar sequence. Some of it she knew only by report, and she said that. But the events themselves were so compelling that no one seemed to mind. The Benignity intrusion, the lagging pair of Benignity ships, possibly a new tactic, possibly malfunction. No one knew for sure. The successful attack on those ships, the damage to one assault carrier, the effective ambush of the killer scout sent to form its own ambush, the long and dangerous harrying of the invaders in their course to Xavier, the loss of the space station, the damage to the Xavierin cities.
Only a scorch, after all.
Esme stopped short. She could not see against the glare of light focused on her who had spoken.
Only a scorch. Someone thinks a scorch is a minor problem? Let me show you the video.
She switched to that, the former capital of Xavier on one side of the screen, as it had been, a small city of wide streets and low stone buildings, gardens, and tree-shaded parks. That was file footage from fleet databanks. Xavier's own records had all been destroyed. On the half-screen, an uneven field of rubble, the shattered remains of trees, the languid columns of smoke twisting in their own heat, a damage assessment team from Fleet in their protective gear. The video pickup had zoomed in on dead bodies, human and animal. Esme recognized a dead horse, if no one else did.
All population centers were reduced like this. Fire destroyed outlying settlements, as well as millions of hectares of pasture and farm crops. A scorch is intended to leave the planet barely habitable for the Benignity's own troops, with return to agriculture production in 3 to 5 years. That doesn't leave much for the people who live there.
But weren't they all killed?
No, thanks to the foresight of Commander Serrano and their own government. Most of the population survived in remote regions. They have caves, I heard. But their economic base is gone. It will take a generation or two just to recover what they lost.
Esme could imagine the sequence. The years of hunger, while they reestablished their agricultural base. The years after that, when just enough to eat was no longer enough. As distant as they were, they could not expect much help from the rest of the Familius, once some new crisis caught public attention. Silence again, this time with a different flavor. Esme changed displays to show the Xavier system again.
Let's begin with the situation as it first appeared to Commander Serrano. Xavier had been troubled by periodic incursions over the past few years that appeared to be independent raiders of some sort. These had threatened the orbital station and, in fact, had damaged it on more than one occasion. Xavier's only defense consisted of outmoded, undersupported Demoiselle-class ships, of which only one was really spaceworthy. The others had been cannibalized for parts to keep that one working. The government enlisted Commander Serrano, then acting as a civilian captain of a private yacht, but a very well-armed one, in defense against such a raider. As you might expect, the unsuspecting raider didn't have a chance.
How big was it?
According to scan reports at the time, it was an Athar's World raider. Commander Serrano anticipated its attack course and was able to surprise it.
But that wasn't the whole battle, was it? One lousy little raider?
No, of course not. Commander Serrano's scan techs noticed another ship in the system, which appeared to be an observer. She suspected that the raider's attack was merely a probe for a larger invasion force. She transmitted that concern to the nearest fleet headquarters.
And got a bunch of traitors.
Not a bunch. Most of the officers and crew of all three ships were loyal, or things would have turned out very differently. Fleet dispatched a small force under the command of Deccan Garavay. 2 patrol ships, 1 cruiser. The captains of all 3 ships were prepared to cooperate with the Benignity. The problem for the Benignity, as I understand it, is that the sort of thing they planned at Xavier required their long-standing agents to identify themselves to each other. A very risky affair. This need to confer was their undoing. Commander Serrano had to prevent Garavay from destroying Xavier's orbital station, and she needed those ships to defend from the expected invasion. That meant she had to relieve Garavay and the other traitors' captains of their commands, identify any other traitors, and rally the loyal crews.
But how did Serrano get command?
I can only tell you what I heard. Apparently, she and some of her former crew got aboard by some ruse and asked to talk to Garavay in his office. By good fortune, or perhaps she had some way of knowing, some of the other conspirators were there. She and her crew killed them.
Right away? You mean they didn't try to talk them out of it?
When someone has determined on treason, is commanding a ship and planning to deliver helpless civilians to the enemy, I doubt any moral homilies would change his mind. Commander Serrano made a command decision. She eliminated the most senior conspirators as quickly as possible. Even then, it wasn't easy.
Esme put up new displays.
Now, Captain Hearn took despite, with me and the rest of the crew, quickly out of Xavier's system. Our exec was also involved, but the next junior officer was both loyal and on the bridge to hear Commander Serrano's transmission to Captain Hearn, requesting her to return to station and her assistance in defending Xavier. He actually began the mutiny, appealing to the bridge crew.
She stopped, flooded in memories of the next few hours. The contradictory orders on the ship's internal communications, the total confusion, the time it took, which now seemed inexplicable, for the Loyalists to realize that a mutiny was necessary, and that they'd have to use deadly force on their crewmates.
From the tactical point of view, Commander Serrano faced a very difficult task. The Benignity force arrived almost simultaneously with her assumption of command.
Now, describing decisions and actions she had not personally witnessed, she found it easier to be calm and logical. This ship here, these over there, expected and unexpected choices of maneuver. Results, neatly tabulated without reference to the people whose lives had just been changed forever. All too soon, she had to come back to her own experience. Esme displayed another visual.
We came in too fast. My concern was that we might arrive too late, and I assumed that any insertion barrage would be sufficiently dispersed. So we blew past Xavier, and in that interim, Paradox took fatal damage.
More than 1,800 dead. Her fault. War left no margin for mistakes. She remembered the desperate scramble on the bridge of her ship, the bridge crew fighting to get control, to get a jump solution that would let them get back in time to do some good.
We got a jump solution, and we came out of jump with a clear shot up the rear of the Benignity Command cruiser.
And a vector that gave them only one chance for that shot. The crew that had resented losing a chance to become the sector gunnery champions had made their shot in the narrow window, and then had managed to reposition Despite in a stable orbit.
The Board of Inquiry did not approve of the means, though they liked the results.
Esme didn't want to discuss that. She hurried on to show how the Xavierin defenses had contributed, the suicidal use of phase cannon on a shuttle, the improvised mines, little Grogan's few telling shots, the yacht's astonishing defeat of the killer ship.
Only because they weren't expected. The Benignity ship intended ambush. Post-battle analysis picked up enough transmissions to know that, and simply didn't know the yacht was there. When it shut down active systems to lie low for several hours, it was an easy target.
What difference would it have made if Despite had also been in the Xavier system the whole time?
By the ship's stats, it would have improved the odds ratio only about 15%. To my own knowledge, Despite had the best weapons performance in the sector. But if it had stayed, it would have been a known quantity, and Commander Serrano's force would still have been outnumbered and outgunned. I haven't seen any of the senior analyst reports, but my own guess is that its contribution throughout the long battle would have been less than its effectiveness as an unexpected opponent at the end. That is, however, only my guess. It does not change the fact that the lack of another hull severely limited Captain Serrano's choices of action, and that its absence was the result of treason.
The audience paused, attentive and almost breathless. Esme waited. Finally, someone shifted, and that broke their immobility. Hands rose for more questions, but Esme caught sight of senior rank in the rear.
When did they come in?
Well, Lieutenant Suiza, on behalf of the whole tactical group, I'd like to thank you for a riveting presentation.
Detton saw them, finally.
Sir?
Commander Adarin. Esme finally recognized as he moved out of the dimness back there and into the light.
I presume you'd be willing to give the same briefing to senior officers?
A shiver of apprehension ran down Esme's backbone. She couldn't tell if he was angry or amused. She didn't know whether to apologize or explain.
Of course, sir.
She choked back the automatic qualifiers. If she wasn't really qualified, why was she showing off to the ensigns?
If I could have a word.
Adarin's glance raked the ensigns, who immediately began scrambling from their seats to leave by the other entrance.
Of course, sir.
Esme retrieved her display cube from the projector and came down from the dais. Major Patak was not one of the officers there, and she didn't recognize any of the others besides Adarin. They gazed at the departing ensigns with the kind of neutral expression which she interpreted as trouble on the half-shell and bubbling from the broiler. Adarin said nothing more until the ensigns had gone.
Very clearly explained, I thought. I was impressed with your analysis of your own errors. Well, Lieutenant Suiza, I think you'd better expect an invitation to the Senior Tactics Discussion Group. I quite realize that you aren't a senior analyst, but I doubt we can resist having a first-hand account of so striking an engagement.
Yes, sir.
And you might want to check the orientation of your Illustration 8. I think you've got the axes rotated 90 degrees, unless there is a reason for that.
Yes, sir.
With a nod, Adarin led the other officers out. Esme felt like falling into one of the seats and shaking for a half hour, but Detton was peering in at her, obviously hoping to chat.